Welcome to Baron Talks. I'm Dr. Ralph Ford, and you are listening to a very special episode today. My guest is Dr. Lena Sersko-Harned, an assistant teaching professor of political science and an expert in the politics of the Ukraine and the post-Soviet space. Dr. Harned holds a PhD and master's degree in political science from the University of Pittsburgh and a bachelor's in political science from Edinburgh University of Pennsylvania. In addition to being a great teacher here at Penn State Barron, she serves as a senior policy analyst at our Public Policy Fund, which is based in our School of Humanities and Social Sciences. Dr. Harned is from the Ukraine and still has family in the country. So welcome here under these trying circumstances. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. And I'm sorry to do this, Dr. Ford, but I am going to correct you straight off the bat. We do not put article the in front of Ukraine.
My apologies.
I know Ukraine. It takes a while for a Western audience to catch up with that, but I am going to go ahead and do that straight off.
I'll work as best as I can on Kiev. How's that?
So we'll sounds great.
Try to get that one right. But very seriously, you know, your family's there. You're going through this. It's a really trying time. Are you willing to talk a little bit about how's your family doing?
Sure. So I do have family in Kyiv, in the capital. There is also some relatives scattered across central Ukraine and three different regions, if not more. My folks in Kyiv, it's my sister and my aunt and my cousins. They are sheltering in place. They also have been using the bomb shelters to keep safe. They are, you know, doing the best that they can. There's shortages of food now in the city. There's constant air raids, constant sirens. It's a very tense situation. I think once they now got over the initial shock of the last 4 days, they, as other civilians around them, you know, men volunteered mostly and went, many men volunteered and went into the territorial defense units. My cousins are underage, but both my aunt and my sister are discussing of joining some kind of volunteer force to help with the humanitarian issues in the city right now. Like I said, now that the initial horror and terror is a little bit settled, and the curfew also that's been in place the entire weekend has been lifted this morning, so people are actually able to move around the city a little more freely.
I know it has to be incredibly difficult. And just so our audience knows, we're recording this on, things are changing so quickly. We're recording this on the morning of February 28th. I know that there were talks going on between the Ukrainian diplomats and Russian this morning. I have no idea where that stands. Could you just give us a, you know, where do things stand as best as you understand right now, today? And I realize that there's a lot to that, but.
As far as the talks go on, it looks like, and I'm reading this live, actually, Twitter has been, and also there are several news sources that are from Ukraine that I absolutely trust. And I'm seeing that the two sides agreed to keep talking. That is all that I know as of this moment. And it can be seen as a positive side, but at the same time, the unfortunate situation is that even for this brokered peace talks, the agreement was that there will be no firings, and that has not been the case. City of Kyiv, its suburbs, city of Kharkiv, Chernihiv, all over Ukraine, civilians are being targeted by Russian military, and this is sort of speaks to hypocrisy of this particular peace talks. But as of right now, they agreed to keep talking. So we'll know more what those negotiations yielded, if anything.
Well, I'll tell you, it's better than I think most of us anticipated, in that we figured they'd walk away and have nothing. We'll see where it goes. But, you know, I'd like to step back. I don't know how much people in the U.S. really understand about Ukraine. And it's a large country. It's quite large, 44 million people, quite diverse. So I'm asking you a tough question here, but, you know, why, you know, the question is, people, why Ukraine, first of all? Why is Russia so interested? And we're going to dig deep into that. But what is it we should know about Ukraine? And can you give us just some background for our listeners?
Yes, Ukraine, as you say, is a large country. It possesses tremendous amount of natural resources. It is, not to beat up the term, but it is the breadbasket of Europe. It does supply a tremendous amount of agricultural goods throughout the world. Ukraine also is the place for the gas reserves and coal. So there are some very important elements in Ukraine that make it, from nothing else but strategically and economically, of interest to the Russian Federation. What makes it of interest further is this idea that Vladimir Putin expressed several times, that Ukraine belongs to Russia, that somehow these last 30 years of Ukrainian independence that Ukraine regained, and I stress it, regained in 1991 after USSR collapsed, he claims that it was all a mistake. And somehow there is, he claims, some, you know, his rant about this is extraordinary. He published an essay about this last July. His declaration of war speech last Wednesday night, this Thursday morning, was absolutely remarkable. Lesson in Putin-esque history, claiming that there is a sort of, on one hand, fraternal belonging between Russians and Ukrainians and Belarusians, like that somehow we are same people and therefore ought to be reunited and live together in one happy family. But at the same time, then by his own definition, what is being committed right now is fratricide, plain and simple.
At least 300 civilians, I think, as of yesterday, had been killed in the bombings, and a number of children as well. And, you know, that's probably an underestimate to your point. I want to stick with his claims. And, you know, that July publication he made last year, I think, has kind of roundly been criticized as being propaganda. But there's a shared history between the two countries, to be sure, where they've gone back and forth and had connections. And in fact, one time, I think Kiev was a much more powerful city than Moscow ever was. So there's some shared history and similar language, but there are distinct differences in the people. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. And, you know, the interesting thing about this is that particular essay and some of his writing, and I'm speaking right now as a scholar of nationalism here, and not so much as a person familiar with Ukrainian history, but a scholar of nationalism. That is a perfect example, actually, of a reconstructed history to suit a certain ideology. And I am convinced that Putin has, over the last several years, over the last decade, with aid of handful of folks in his own surroundings, not the least of which is actually Russian Orthodox Church itself, helped him construct this narrative of Russian world, of this Ruskiy Mir, right? This idea of holy Russia that dates back to prehistoric times, right? There has this, and all of this, of course, reeks of primordial nationalism. And what we know about those kinds of primordial nationalism is everything, just that. History becomes a tool for constructing a narrative that justifies nationalistic projects. And this is exactly the kind of stuff that we are seeing unfold before our eyes in Putin's claims on Ukraine, and not just Ukraine, on Belarus, on territories in the Caucasus, on territories in Central Asia. Who knows where he's going to stop?
Yeah, I think it's surprising to everybody and shocking, and maybe it shouldn't be. And, you know, we can get into the what's been happening in the last 10 years and kind of the signals that have been coming. But when you really look at what I think Putin's mindset is, as much as I can read it as anybody else, though, I think we do know pretty well. He believes in the Soviet Union, and he believes in the restoration of the Soviet-type satellite republics that they liked. And he sees this very much as the first step in doing that, and where he might go afterwards, who knows?
Yes, and I think it's also, right, I think it's older than Soviet Union. So by looking at his ideology, I find it very interesting in how these seemingly variable parts of Russian history fit into the story of this Holy Russia, right? That it serves a much broader purpose. Soviet Union in this particular depiction of history then becomes one of the stages through which the Russian Empire has gone through, right? So some of the claims that he's making are actually like dating back to the empire or even prior to that. So I think it's more than just the restoration of the Soviet Union, because again, I think one of the things that we might be missing sometimes when we think about Soviet Union is that ideology element, mm-hmm. right? He's by no means a Marxist. So that's not the kind of Soviet Union we're talking about,
yeah.
right? So what he's really talking about here is restoration of territorial pieces of empire, of the greater, bigger empire of what it was before the Soviet Union. And Soviet Union, in his mind, might very well be simply a manifestation of that empire, but under the circumstances of Marxism-Leninism.
Yeah, I think it's more of a balance of power issue than, mm-hmm. is, say, a Marxist philosophy. That's, but I'd like to ask this question. I mean, he is clearly bothered, upset, cannot stand NATO. I mean, NATO is very, very much in his speeches as well. And while we view it as a mutual defense agreement, he views it as something different. Does he have a point in that?
So this is a really interesting conversation to be had about NATO altogether. On one hand, there is probably something rational about fearing NATO on part of Russia, in the sense that from the very beginning, right, that famous quote about Russia, NATO being created to keep Americans in and Germans down and Russians out of the European security, something, right, that sort of resonated across the Cold War period. And after Cold War, and there's plenty of evidence to it. Again, as someone who studied Russian foreign policy, I can absolutely attest that the Russians have attempted to engage with NATO and West in terms of reconstructing the security schema of the Northern Hemisphere. Of course, they negotiated the NATO-Russia Council that specified certain elements of cooperation. But in 2000s, but that was, you know, still under Yeltsin, but since Putin had taken over, he's been persistent in addressing NATO as an obsolete organization, and pinpointing to that thing that, you know, if you are indeed going to try to not see Russia as a threat, then stop behaving in a threatening way. So in essence, to put it in the terms of international relations, this is your classic security dilemma, right? In the sense that two sides might not be wanting to perceive each other's threats, but mm-hmm. yet sheer presence of each other
causes
a perception of threat, which causes them to behave in a threatening way because they're attempting to defend themselves, right? That very famous sort of Latin term, right? Si vis pacem, para bellum, right? That is, if you want peace, prepare for war, right? That is the perfect sort of element of this security dilemma. So I think in regard, that probably has some merit in that particular regard. But at the same time, if you look historically at what NATO actually has done, it has absolutely done nothing to threaten Russia. Article 5 for the first time was used for, you know, after the attack of 9/11 in Afghanistan, not in Russia, not anywhere near Russia. But I suppose, yes, the security dilemma is present. Why in Ukraine? Why now? That's a whole different conversation, a whole different question.
Well, we're going to come back to that. That's on my list, but I want to stick with NATO for just a bit longer. I think, you know, there is one thing in the NATO charter that also speaks to the fact that in order to join, you have to be committed to the principles of freedom and liberal democracy or something along those lines, right? So in fact, we didn't even let Slovakia in, I think, until they changed their government. So I'm not arguing in his favor, but you could see the point of what it's doing is it is saying it's getting closer to his borders with changing the governments and the type of governments they are, right? And that must be his great fear, is that the influence becomes greater in the in Ukraine than it currently is.
No, absolutely. And that has been also his fear from early 2000s, from the Orange Revolution in 2004. And right, he's talked about color revolutions and his fear of color revolutions all along. Because, again, I think you hit the nail on the head here in terms of expectations of democracy and Putin's absolute repulsion at that notion. Yeah. I think that is his probably cynical side. And by the way, it's shared by many Russians, right, who had an experience of democracy or what they thought was democracy in 1990s, which was nothing close to democracy, right? We can best describe this plebiscite at its worst manifestation, and sort of the economic downturn that Russian and the whole former Soviet Union experienced at the time. So there is this element of one hand experience with not really a democracy, but what they perceived as democracy, but also then the cynical side that really democratic governance really is a charade, right? That it's another way for elites to exert their power over an educated public. And this is precisely what Putin's perception of democracy in Ukraine and Eastern Europe, for that matter, was. That it's not really an expression of people's will, like you and I might think about democracy, but rather a clever manipulation by some elites, right? Whoever they might be. In his mind, of course, it's all American government. That's doing all of this, that's manipulating these people into overthrowing their legitimate regimes, and all for the purpose of again threatening Russia. So it goes back again to it's all in perception. Whereas, of course, as a scholar of democracy and democratization, and someone who has lived in democracy and not a democracy, right? I have a very different perception of what democracy really is.
Sure. I don't have the same, but I can, you know, if there's a better system, not quite sure what it is, but the values of liberal democracy have served humanity well for a long period of time, and their systems have not as well. But that's maybe a different discussion. Now, back to the current conflict, and it's, you know, if you were watching the news, it may have felt like it just came out of nowhere in the last couple months as Putin started to really become very aggressive. He's known for this type of behavior, but it's not. I mean, this has been going on, escalating for 10 years, and there have been a number of conflicts in the Eastern Breakaway Republics, as they're called, at least by the Russians, I believe, and Crimea. So could you walk us through that and tell us what's happening? What's going on there?
Sure.
Or how this built up, excuse me.
Yeah, sure. So the story here, I probably should take you back more than 10 years ago and take you to 2004, when the first Orange Revolution, right, that was called at the time, occurred. Now, mind you, that is first sort of a big, huge event that was really covered in the Western media, and I think it still sort of lives maybe in some memory of some folks who observed Eastern European politics or politics in generally, but there's been other protests before then. And what has happened in that particular event, that a more authoritarian leader, a more authoritarian candidate, was supported by the Russian Federation. And they attempted to rig an election. And those Ukrainians who were supporting a opposite, the more democratic, but also person with ties to United States and more Western leaning, that is leaning toward European integration for Ukraine as a path forward candidate, they took to the streets. And the result of that Orange Revolution, which by the way lasted, it was very peaceful, mostly protests in the city of Kyiv. And that resulted in the parliament agreeing to have a runoff election and constitutional amendments to allow for more separation, taken away, more power taken away from the office of presidency, right? And divulged towards the parliament. Mm. 4 years on, the pro-Russian candidate who lost in that particular election ran again, this time with tremendous amount of help. And we know this, with tremendous amount of help financially from the Russian Federation. And I am going to throw this name out there because I don't think it's incidental or accidental, but I'm not making any claims here, mind you. I'm just stating a matter of fact that one of the people who helped elect that particular person was Paul Manafort, who also created tremendous wake here in the United States in recent history. So that particular pro-Russian candidate won, and he was pressured by the Russian Federation, by Vladimir Putin, to turn the course of Ukrainian choice for European integration toward Russia. On November 21st, I believe, or 20th of the 2013, the agreement was supposed to be signed between EU and Ukraine, the association agreement. And the president at the time, the pro-Russian candidate, and the president refused. And there's good reason to believe that it was done with the pressure from Russian Federation. Mm-hmm. That refusal led to protests. The government reacted absolutely appallingly to those protests, violently, which sparked a full demand for the resignation of Yanukovych government, and hence the revolution which ousted him. He ended up running away from Kyiv, from Ukraine altogether, to Russia, where he supposedly now still resides. Since that revolution, which also then in clashes between government forces and protesters claimed over 100 lives in the center of Kyiv between protesters and, of course, the government forces, which, by the way, was absolutely horrific and violent in its own right, the government was sniper shooting its own people. Wow. So you can imagine why Ukrainians, those who felt that democracy was a proper way to go, did not want to see those kinds of violations of human rights. Well, since then, of course, several big things happened. Ukraine took a turn towards the West hard, rejecting in many ways anything to do with what Russian Federation had to offer. Ukraine also adopted a very democratic constitution, which is why you are seeing that there are a tremendous variety of views happening in Ukraine. From, yes, extreme on the right to extreme on the left, and also pro-Russian forces that also was sitting, the pro-Russian party was actively sitting in the parliament. And they put up a candidate for presidential election. I guarantee you they would not have had such an opportunity, an authoritarian regime. Right? So I want to stress that Ukraine did adopt democratic principles and was functioning on them ever since, absolutely, the for the last 20 years, there's been free and fair elections in Ukraine. But also then, seizing an opportunity of this civil strife that occurred right after the revolution, Vladimir Putin moved in quite opportunistically to seize Crimea, mm-hmm. Which was, I want to remind, occupied first by armed folks, unidentified armed folks who forced Ukrainian military out of Crimea and Ukrainian administration out of Crimea, and then imposed this referendum that happened in Crimea at the gunpoint, basically, which joined it with the Russian Federation. And shortly thereafter, the same occurred, same scenario was attempting to be unfolded in the eastern regions of Ukraine, but there, of course, the Ukrainian military was not eager to leave peacefully. and they put up a fight, which led to, of course, one of the, up until now, one of the more horrific pages in Ukrainian modern history. And that war in Donbas continued now for 8 years, claiming over 14,000 lives.
Yeah, it's tragic. And, you know, in Crimea as well, I think it's worth saying again, the referendum, and I say that in air quotes, was, you know, suspect at best, to be sure, in terms of the will of the people. And I saw a recent, some recent data, I'm probably just getting it close, but basically, you know, as you said, there's a variety of opinions across the Ukraine, but it continues to trend the public opinion more towards the West than the East. And I think it's about 70% would prefer kind of a Western style democracy is the number I've seen. So that's got to be weighing on the Russian government and Putin as well, in that they just see the way that this is going.
But I think that Russian government and Vladimir Putin so much don't care about public opinion. I let me say it. I shouldn't say they don't care. They used to suppress it, right? Because, again, people and their opinions in a great game of high politics matter not.
Mm-hmm.
And Putin probably believed that by installing appropriate regime in Ukraine, not a democratic one, but the authoritarian one that did not take hard stances on Russian integration, would be just as easily and happily received in Ukraine. Of course, he's very wrong about that.
So, I mean, that's his stated goal of this campaign right now, is to overthrow the government that exists, remove the Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky. You know, who knows what he has in mind for him, and then replace it with a different government. Putin's been very clear about that.
Yeah, I mean, when he refers to this denazification of Ukraine, right, which has been repeated several times now by Foreign Minister of Russia as well, basically, yes, they believe that somehow Ukraine is run by this extreme right government that is abusive to its own people, and this is absolute nonsense in so many ways. Of course, and Western media has covered this by pointing out that, listen, a person of Jewish descent is the president of Ukraine.
Yeah.
Prime minister of Ukraine before him was also of Jewish descent. And like I said, there's plenty of, Ukraine is a multi-ethnic society, which Ukrainians embrace.
That surprised a lot of people, at least me, when I heard this denazification and that brought into the argument. But is that because he's just playing to the home crowd in Russia, you know, saying this is like World War II all over again and the Nazis are coming our way?
Yeah, so this is great, actually. So this is actually part of the some work that I'm working right now, some publications that are in the works for me, where I explore this particular ideology that I mentioned before, this Ruskiy Mir ideology, this Russian world one. And it seems to me that there is some kind of messianic, almost holy war thing happening here, right? That Putin is thinking that he is waging this war upon the Western liberal order, right? This godless liberal order, manipulative and greedy, which is all kinds of things to say about Putin. There's just all kinds of cognitive dissonance there going on. But anyway, what helps with the image of Nazis, right, is resurrection of the Great Patriotic War, which was World War II. It was called Great Patriotic War in the Soviet Union because it was seen as the great war of liberation of Soviet Union against the occupying Nazi Germany. So the image of Nazism, right, is really a very powerful one for domestic audiences, and it does conjure the stories and this reminiscence of the heroism of World War II, which also is quite problematic. in its own right. Most of the fighting at the time was done on Ukrainian territory and Belarus.
Mm-hmm.
Those were the two major fronts. So it was, again, Ukrainian people that suffered in that war disproportionately also and gave many of their lives.
Millions, I think, is the number who died, right?
Yeah, millions upon millions. What Putin also is playing is in a little bit of history, and I'm going to mention this, least I am being will be accused of being unobjective, which I'm sure I will be, and I'm going to claim straight away. I am definitely far from being objective at this point when it comes to analyzing Vladimir Putin and his policy, let alone his personality. One of the arguments that he's making, and some I hear a lot, the Russian media and ordinary Russians making, is connecting the Ukrainian nationalism, right? That is Ukraine's desire to be independent from Russia,
mm-hmm.
to the old story that dates back to World War II, when Ukrainian nationalists purportedly collaborated with Nazis in order to fight the Red Army. Now, is there merit to some of those facts? Probably. But at the same time, Ukrainian nationalists were fighting for their motherland, regardless of the occupier. And there's plenty of history describing and detailing that. After World War II, Ukrainian nationalists continued to put up a hell of a fight as an insurgency in some of the regions of Western Ukraine, for instance, and intellectually all across Ukraine. There's examples of even as late in 1980s of great Ukrainian intellectuals who were nationalistic being absolutely destroyed, executed, murdered by the Soviet Empire.
Let's jump to what's happening on the ground today. So I guess to the surprise of everybody, I mean, the wisdom was, as much as there's any wisdom about this, first of all, the shock and horror that this was actually happening. I think most people were just hoping beyond all odds that it wouldn't happen, but that Kiev would fall in 24 to 48 hours. And that hasn't happened. And the story is turning out to be a bit different. Countries around the world are responding maybe in a way we didn't anticipate. And I think if you could talk to us about that, what's from your perspective, what's really happening, and is this more than Russia expected? Did they bite off more than they could chew, perhaps?
Yeah, I think, again, expectations and perceptions definitely did not play into Vladimir Putin's hands. Now, why did this happen? There's a bunch of reasons. But one of the big misperceptions, I think, and again, I'm not the author of this particular thought. It has been circulated over the last few days, but it resonates with me also very much that Russia, or rather Vladimir Putin, believed that he was fighting a corrupt state. That's exactly what he's been saying. In reality, he's fighting a nation united, a nation that absolutely has zero desire for his brand of statehood that he has in mind for this particular nation. So the result of this was that instead of being greeted by grateful citizens of Ukraine who will either, you know, at the extreme, would be very grateful to be liberated from this oppressive regime, as Putin has painted it, would at least do nothing and collaborate with the Russian liberation forces, instead turned into an absolute defense. Ukrainians are waging their own version of great patriotic war. He did not expect the territorial defense units. He did not expect ordinary Ukrainians of all ages and all genders mixing Ukrainian cocktails, right? The so-called
Ukrainian cocktail versus Molotov, of course. Yes.
Of course, yes. Ukrainians are reclaiming that particular title. Not to refer to Molotov, right? Not to give the Soviet history any more presence in our liberation.
I'd like listeners to know, you know, maybe in case they didn't catch it.
Yes, that's a good point. And I think that was a great miscalculation. Great miscalculation. Because again, from that perspective of that particular ideology that spurring Vladimir Putin on. In terms of international order, this last 4 days have been just monumental in how much international order has changed. Countries' traditional positions shattered, turned 180 degrees. Right now, Switzerland has declared that they're going to be imposing sanctions. The one that claimed neutrality for how many generations? European countries, United States, even Australia, right?
Australia's gotten in. Yes.
Right. Japan. This is a tremendous kind of shakeup.
You know, sanctions are a discussion in themselves, and they can not be effective. But I think what's happening here is they're being shut out of the world banking system and other things that probably they didn't anticipate. And I saw, and I didn't really get to read it this morning, but they raised interest rates in Russia, like from 9% to 20%.
20, mm-hmm. Correct.
And, I mean, that's crazy. Mm-hmm. See, I mean, that says something's going on. So, I mean, hopefully, I know we've only got a few minutes left, but the Ukrainian people don't have to keep fighting this terrible war, and their peace will break out. But he still has a lot. Russia, and we all say he, but we do know that Putin is largely alone on this one. It doesn't seem as though his country or all his advisors are there. He's got a smaller and smaller group around him. He's acting more and more unilaterally, is he not? And,
it's really interesting. I cannot really answer this completely authoritatively. Because on one hand, there is a dissent. We know that there is plenty of intellectuals within Russia that have voiced their concerns. In more recently, which very also surprising, the Communist Party of Russian Federation has also raised concerns, even though they were the ones that originated that infamous law that allowed recognition of LDNR, the breakaway republics, last week. But they claim that they were misled and fooled into this whole war. So do many others. At the same time, we see protests, however few, but they have happened. And credit ought to be given to the brave people who do go to protest. Even though, again, I am overwhelmed with the fact that so many Russians have allowed for this particular dictator to continue to preside over their country. But we are where we are. There's some conversation also about oligarchs. Big, powerful people who are Russians with a lot of money who are also speaking out against. Deripaska, Abramovich, just to name a few, right, just recently have voiced their discontent, or rather their disapproval of war. So there's some speculation that among Vladimir Putin's there might be some defection. But if you listen to Russian propaganda, if you listen to Russian news channels, if you still take sort of a look at public opinion, just cursorily done, I'm not seeing much change. And there's still quite a few people who support this this war and this idea that Russia will win and Ukraine ought to be joined with Russia and Ukrainian government ought to be overthrown. And this is still not seen really as a war, but as a special operation of liberation of Ukraine.
My guess is, that sort of change for people to see it differently who are in Russia or have sympathies. By the way, I do have some other Ukraine friends who are sympathetic to have a different position than yours. It's a little hard for me to understand, frankly, but it does exist. I think it takes time. But I think when the world sees that civilians are in fact being bombed and what's happening, hopefully that changes perception. Let me, just two last things. And like I said, I'll give you, of course, the last word. But For those who are listening and want to help the Ukrainian people, what can they do?
So there's a ton of organizations that people can donate to. There, just a simple Ukrainian government, for instance, also allowed for some banks allowed for easy payments to directly to Ukrainian government to make donations. And I absolutely would urge folks to look at their sources before they make donations to make sure that they are. But, I believe that the State Department has actually put together a list where folks can donate. Another good organization to start here in the United States is Razom, razom.ua. That makes collections, and they also have been functioning since 2014, since the Revolution of Dignity, but they do a lot for the efforts right now. So there are ways to be involved, absolutely.
Said food is becoming scarce. We didn't need, the humanitarian impact, millions of people heading towards the Poland border. This is really in its infancy still in terms of the human impact. And like you said, your family themselves are just getting over the initial shock. What's your final message, or how would you like to close out, Lena?
Since our audience is here in the United States, I think I want to warn folks and make a plea to them not to be misled, to be careful consumers of information that they are receiving. The information war is definitely part of this. You will see a lot of stuff coming about Ukrainians firing upon themselves, which is complete nonsense. Be careful of the images that you consume. Be careful of information that is coming your way. Know your propagandists, shall I say. And another thing is, I heard a lot of sort of disheartening conversation in the United States about why should we care? And I think Americans have a lot at stake here too, whether you realize it or not, that all this fighting on the other part of the world is not without consequence here. Ukrainians are fighting for freedom and not just their own. They are fighting for democracy and not just their own. And that's an important thing that we need to remember. Again, as one of Ukrainians said, I'm not the author of this quote, so I cannot take credit, but it's a great one, that it seems we are in a world war and Russia is fighting everyone and Ukrainians are fighting for everyone. So that's going to be my closing remark at this point.
Well, really well said. I will then add one more point. And the reason Americans and everyone should care is a country was invaded that was a functioning, non-aggressive democracy. And that hasn't happened in a long time. That's a big change. And that's how world wars have started. So we absolutely should care, and we should be very concerned about it. Well, you have been listening to a very special episode of Barron Talks today. I'm Dr. Ralph Ford, Chancellor of Penn State Barron, and our guest has been Dr. Lena Zersko-Harned, one of our faculty members, and of course grew up in Ukraine. Your family's there. We can't underestimate the impact and what you're going through, and so much appreciate you coming on to talk to us today and sharing your perspective. It is greatly appreciated. You have a good day.
Thank you.
Thank you.